Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 1 of For the Record program number 677, Update on Global Fascism. This program is being recorded on June 20th of the year 2009. Happy summer solstice, more or less, to people in the audience. We're going to plunge right in. In a recent broadcast, we looked at we closed that program looking at the prognostications of the British education minister. He was worried that the economic downturn was going to lead to a rise in fascism around the world, or a reemergence of fascism. And we're going to be taking a look at global fascism, and we're going to begin by taking a look at an article that talks about economic weakness in Europe and how it appears to be fueling the rise of the European far right, or the renaissance of the European far right. This article is by someone named Justice Lytle, or someone who writes under that name. This is from the marketoracle.co.uk website. It's titled, European Union Being Held Together with Duct Tape. It's dated June 10th of 2009. It reads, among its many other sins, the greenback is a press hog. The world's reserve currency, loved and loathed as it is, simply gets most of the ink these days. In that light, a U.S.-based commentator, not least your cynical Taipan Daily scribes, have repeatedly waxed eloquent on the long-run death of the dollar. But in our zeal, we sometimes forget that in order for the dollar to die, it has to die relative to other fiat currency offerings, and some of those are looking pretty sick as well. The main exception, of course, being gold, the one and only stateless currency, unquote, not subject to the whims of a printing press. As Grant's Interest Rate Observer quips, quote, show us a monetary asset whose value is not subject to governmental debasement and we will show you a Krugerrand, unquote. In short, the dollar is not the only basket case out there. Take the euro, for example. Now there's a troubled currency if ever one existed. As Pollyanna stock market bulls are finding out the hard way, rising interest rates via falling bond prices can have ugly consequences. The same is true of a rising currency when coupled with a weak economic backdrop. In this particular case, the stronger the euro gets, the more it cuts into European export sales. At a time when most all of Europe is sick, the economic pain of a too strong currency becomes intense above a certain threshold. On top of that, various bits of Europe are now in the process of blowing up or falling apart or both. There is deep trouble brewing in multiple corners of the continent. Let's take a quick look on a country-by-country basis to see why Europe is being held together with duct tape. We'll start with Britain, not an adopter of the euro, but a member of the EU nonetheless. Britain has been hurled into political chaos thanks to an unholy combo of deep financial crisis, explosive Labour Party scandals, and the hapless, lame duck status of embattled Prime Minister Gordon Brown. Cabinet ministers are resigning left and right in protest as Brown's popularity plummets, calling for the Prime Minister to step down. Election results tallied this week show the Labour Party, Brown's party, putting in its worst showing since 1918. Philip Stevens, chief political commentator for the Financial Times, sees an ominous chain of events now set in motion. Quote, everyone thought the election results would be bad, Stevens reports, but these results are calamitous. The Prime Minister was prepared, if you like, for very bad results. He's now got to grapple with absolutely terrible results, unquote. If the Brown government fails, Britain will be left rudderless in the midst of the worst fiscal storm in decades. In a worst-case scenario, where bad events lead to worse decisions, opines Stevens, the domino chain could even lead to a British exit from the EU. This outbreak of chaos is awful and unsettling for the British economy, and by extension, awful and unsettling for Europe. As of this writing, it is not yet clear whether Prime Minister Brown can survive a political coup, or even whether he would be better off resigning Dick Nixon-style in the interest of sparing greater turmoil. Elsewhere in Europe, Latvia, a tiny country of 2.2 million, threatens to unleash havoc on the entire continent. Latvia's currency, appropriately known as the lat, is officially pegged to the euro. Latvia set up the currency peg to speed up official entry into the EU, but now the fiscal discipline of maintaining the peg is crushing the Latvian economy. At one time, Latvia was an Eastern European tiger growing by leaps and bounds, but like many other countries, Latvia found itself badly caught out by the financial crisis. Just when credit lines were needed the most to shore up a cratering home front, Latvia found it suddenly impossible to borrow. Credit was desperately needed. An attempt to issue $100 million worth of lat-denominated bonds resulted in no takers. Normally, a small country with an imploding economy would simply devalue the currency to make exports more competitive, but if Latvia devalues now, all kinds of ugly fallout will follow. For one, the Swedish and Austrian banks that lent heavily to Latvia would take huge destabilizing losses. Worse, other European neighbors like Lithuania and Estonia and Bulgaria farther south would see their own currency pegs threatened. And even worse still, a wholesale lat devaluation would crush many Latvian businesses due to loads of foreign currency denominated debt on the books and kill Latvia's shot at eventual EU acceptance. So with the help of emergency financing from the IMF and European Union, Latvia has vowed to keep on keeping on. The currency peg will not go undefended, but in order to maintain that peg in the face of economic hardship, Latvia will need to cut wages and spending to the bone. This, too, is dire medicine for a small country struggling under the weight of great debt. Some believe Latvia will be forced to devalue in spite of all the pain it would cause for both the tiny country itself and many surrounding neighbors. The pressure might just prove too great, as the pressure was too great in 1992 when Britain was forced to devalue the pound and drop out of the European Exchange Rate Mechanism, or ERM. In a way, Latvia is damned if it does and damned if it doesn't. Some argue that the peg must be defended at all costs, lest the whole of Eastern Europe be lost. If Lithuania and Estonia are sucked into a currency pain vortex, the EU could lose its political hold on the region and Russia could rush in to fill the torment-filled vacuum. It would be so much easier and simpler if the value of the euro were to fall from current high levels. This would ease Latvia's pain as well as a number of other struggling countries, but there is a huge and intractable obstacle out there, Germany. As the global financial crisis has unfolded, Angela Merkel, the Chancellor of Germany, has been looked on with increasing amounts of admiration and horror, depending on the observer's vantage point. Those who admire Merkel do so because Germany has appeared to completely go its own way in the midst of turmoil. As other countries have stimulated and relaxed and eased to fight the fires of slowdown, Germany has said nein to anything that smacks of lax fiscal policy. In a speech last week, Chancellor Merkel even went out of her way to slam the Federal Reserve and the Bank of England, stating plainly that, quote, "I view with great skepticism the powers of the Fed, and also how within Europe the Bank of England has carved out its own line," unquote. Within the subtle context of diplomacy and statecraft, those are amazingly blunt words. Merkel has all but called the stimulators a bunch of out-of-control fools. Many admire Germany's fiscal backbone, but others are horrified and terrified by Germany's lack of willingness to show any type of bend or flex in monetary policy. Remember the Latvia problem? Many other rapidly imploding European economies, like those of Ireland and Spain, are also struggling with the weight of a too-strong euro hurting export prospects. But in its zeal for fiscal responsibility, Germany will probably remain steadfast in its opposition to any loosening of the purse strings. The stance is cultural and historical. Having lived through the horror of hyperinflation in the Weimar Republic in the 1920s, Germany emerged from its baptism by fire as a zealous, hard-money advocate. Rigid fiscal discipline has been a political rallying cry in Germany ever since. So when Chancellor Merkel takes an especially hard line against the easy-money inflationist, she is doing so with an eye for public approval ratings at home. The trouble is, even Germany can barely afford its own righteousness. The German economy still depends heavily on exports, and so an overly strong euro hurts Deutschland as well. Last, but not least, a surprising new trend has arisen from the EU-wide elections held in the past few days. Conservatives race toward victory in some of Europe's largest economies Sunday, unquote, the Associated Press reports, again quoting, As initial results and exit polls showed voters punishing left-leaning parties in European Parliament elections in France, Germany, and elsewhere, unquote. The rise includes not just the right, but the far right. In Britain, the British National Party, an openly racist party that only admits whites, gained a seat for the first time. In various other countries, openly nationalist parties gained fresh power, either for the first time also or for the first time in quite a long while. It is not clear why a chunk of the blue-collar working base has swung almost overnight from left to right, says Ambrose Pritchard of the UK Telegraph, again quoting, but clearly, we are seeing the delayed detonation of two political time bombs, rising unemployment, and the growth of immigrant enclaves that resist assimilation, unquote. There are still other problems in Europe we haven't really touched on, like the Spanish real estate markets headed for free fall, the dire state of the Irish economy, joke du jour on the Emerald Isle. What's the difference between Ireland and Iceland? The letter C. And the toxic leverage is still lurking in European banks. Put all this together in what you see is a truly poisonous stew. Half of Europe is still committed to fiscal stimulus and economic coordination, while the other half has swung inward and hard right towards a nationalist and isolationist stance at a time when exports are weak and the whole continent is in trouble. If Pritchard is right in his gloomy assessments, we could be witnessing a scenario where steely fiscal discipline, though a virtue early on, becomes a terrible vice this late in the game. The irony is that those fretting loudest about inflation may themselves tip us into outright deflation with all the perils of a debt compound trap, Pritchard opines. It is Angela Merkel who plays with fire, unquote. By now, the trading takeaway should be fairly obvious. The dollar is not the only paper currency with crash and burn potential. The euro could make for one hell of a great short when the time is right. Whether that time comes sooner or later depends on how events unfold and how quickly the threat of deflationary vice grip leads to inflationary panic, as ultimately occurs in all unsound paper regimes when the last desperate hope of the printing press is embraced as the last resort. Macro Trader will be watching the charts with interest. Of course, not mentioned here is the underground right consideration. It may just be that Germany, aside from the very accurate assessment that the nightmares of German hyperinflation of the 20s have in many ways dictated German fiscal policy since, the fact of the matter is the underground Reich dictates German policy and policy in a hell of a lot of other places as well. And with that very strong currency squeezing the bejesus out of an awful lot of people, it may be that there is, among other things, a very conscious strategy to drive those same blue collars into the ranks of one form or another of fascism. Certainly appears to be going on in Austria, one time part of the fatherland. This is from the Daily Mail Online. It's an article by Billy Briggs, and it is from March 18th of 2009. It's titled, "The Far Right is on the March Again, the Rise of Fascism in Austria." And it reads, "Beneath a leaden sky, the solemn black-clad crowd moves slowly towards a modest gray headstone. At one end of the grave, a flame casts light on the black lettering that is engraved on the marble. At the other end, an elderly soldier bends down to place flowers before standing to salute. From all over Austria, people are here to pay their respects to their fallen hero, but the solemnity of the occasion is cut with tension. Beyond the crowd of about 300, armed police are in attendance, and they keep a respectful distance, but the rasping bark of Alsatians hidden in vans provides an eerie soundtrack as the crowd congregates in mist and light rain. We've been warned that despite a heavy police presence, journalists have often been attacked at these meetings. If trouble does come, then the mob looked ready to fight. There are bull-necked stewards and young men who swagger aggressively. This is a neo-Nazi gathering, and the crowd are some of Austria's most hard-faced fascists. Among them is Gottfried Kussel, a notorious thug who was the showman of Austria's far-right movement in the 80s and 90s until he was imprisoned for 8 years for promoting Nazi ideology. Today, he cuts a Don Corleone figure as he stands defiantly at the graveside. His neo-Nazi acolytes make sure no one comes near him, and our photographer is unceremoniously barged out of his way. Ominous-looking men with scars across their faces whisper to each other and shake hands. These are members of Austria's Burschenschaften, an arcane, secretive organization best known for its fascination with fencing, an initiation ceremony that includes a duel in which the opponents cut each other's faces, and for its strong links to the far right. Incredibly, standing shoulder to shoulder with these hardline Nazi sympathizers are well-known Austrian politicians. At the graveside, a speech is made by Lutz Weinzinger, a leading member of Austria's Freedom Party, or FPO, who pays tribute to the fallen. This is a gathering in memory of an Austrian-born Nazi fighter pilot who, during World War II, shot down 258 planes, 255 of them Russian. Such was Major Walter Nowotny's standing at the time of his death in 1944 that the Nazi Party awarded him a grave of honor in Vienna's largest cemetery, close to the musical legends Mozart, Brahms, and Strauss. But in 2005, that honor was revoked, and his body moved to lie in an area of public graves. The decision infuriated the far right and made their annual pilgrimage an even greater event. Today, the anniversary of Nowotny's death also coincides with Kristallnacht, the night of broken glass in 1938, when 92 people were murdered and thousands attacked across Germany as stormtroopers set upon Jews in an outpouring of Nazi violence. Some 70 years on from that infamous pogrom, the world faces a similar financial crisis to the one that precipitated the rise of Hitler, and in chilling echoes of 30s Europe, support for far-right groups is exploding. Hitler's birthplace has become the focus for neo-Nazis across the world. So I have come to Austria to investigate how fascism and extremism are moving unchecked into the forefront of this society. Last September, Austria's far right gained massive political influence in an election that saw the FPO, along with another far right party, Alliance for the Future, gain 29% of the vote, the same share as Austria's main party, the Social Democrats. The election stirred up terrifying memories of the rise of the Nazi Party in the 30s. And just as the Nazis gained power on the back of extreme nationalism and virulent anti-Semitism, the recent unprecedented gains in Austria were made on a platform of fear about immigration and the perceived threat of Islam. FPO leader Heinz Christian Strache, for example, described women in Islamic dress as female ninjas, unquote. Emboldened by the new power in parliament, neo-Nazi thugs have desecrated Muslim graves. Recently, in Hitler's hometown of Brunau, a swastika flag was publicly unveiled. The FPO wants to legalize Nazi symbols, while its firebrand leader has been accused of having links to far-right extremists. And the FPO's election victory, or after the FPO's election victory, Nick Griffin, leader of the British National Party, sent a personal message to Strache, quote, "We in Britain are impressed to see that you've been able to combine principled nationalism with electoral success. We are sure that this gives you a good springboard for the European elections, and we hope very much that we will be able to join you in a successful nationalist bloc in Brussels next year," unquote. The message followed on from a secret meeting last May in which a high-ranking FPO politician paid a visit to London for a meeting with Griffin. The relationship between the FPO and the BNP becomes more worrying as I learn of the strong links between Austria's political party and hardline Nazis. Herbert Schweiger makes no attempt to hide his Nazi views. At his home in the Austrian mountains, the former SS officer gazes out of a window to a view of a misty alpine valley. Described to me as the puppet master, unquote, of the far right, Schweiger, 85, is a legendary figure for neo-Nazis across the world. Quote, "Our time is coming again, and soon we will have another leader like Hitler," he says. Still remarkably sharp-minded, Schweiger was a lieutenant in the infamous Waffen-SS Panzer Division Leibstandarte Adolf Hitler, an elite unit originally formed before World War II to act as the Führer's personal bodyguards. This is his first interview for 4 years and the first he has ever given to a journalist from outside Austria. It happens a few weeks before he is due to appear in court charged with promoting neo-Nazi ideology. It will be the fifth time he has stood trial for breaking a law, the Verbotsgesetz, enacted in 1947 to halt the spread of fascist ideology. He has been found guilty twice and acquitted twice. It quickly becomes apparent that little has changed in Schweiger's mindset since his Third Reich days. Quote, "The Jew on Wall Street is responsible for the world's current economic crisis. It is the same now as in 1929 when 90% of the money was in the hands of the Jew. Hitler had the right solutions then," he says, invoking the language of Goebbels. The room is filled with mementos from his past and indicators of his sickening beliefs. His bookshelf is a library of loathing. I spot a book by controversial British Holocaust denier David Irving and one on the myth of Auschwitz, unquote. On a shelf hangs a pennant from the SS Death's Head unit that ran Hitler's concentration camps. Such memorabilia is banned in Austria, but Schweiger defiantly displays his Nazi possessions. If Schweiger was an old Nazi living out his final days in this remote spot, it might be possible to shrug him off as a now harmless man living in his past. But Schweiger has no intention of keeping quiet. My job is to educate the fundamentals of Nazism. I travel regularly in Austria and Germany, speaking to young members of our different groups, he says. Schweiger's lectures are full of hate and prejudice. He refers to Jews as intellectual nomads, unquote, and says poor Africans should be allowed to starve. The black man only thinks in the present, and when his belly is full, he does not think of the future, he says, again quoting, "They reproduce en masse even when they have no food, so supporting Africans is suicide for the white race." It is not nation against nation now, but race against race. It is a question of survival that European unites against the rise of Asia. There is an unstoppable war between the white and yellow races. In England and Scotland, there is very strong racial potential. "Of course I am a racist, but I am a scientific racist," he adds, as if this was a justification. Schweiger's raison d'etre is politics. He was a founding member of three political parties in Austria, the VDU, the Band NDP, and the FPO. He has given his support to the current leader of the FPO. By the way, the Freedom Party was headed up by the late Jörg Haider. It was originally formed as a vehicle for politically rehabilitating former members of the Nazi Party in Austria during World War II. Continuing, "Straka is doing the right thing by fighting the foreigner," says Schweiger. "He is now in close contact with Kameradschaften, underground cells of hardcore neo-Nazis across Austria and Germany who over the past 3 years have started to infiltrate political parties such as the FPO. His belief that the bullet and the ballot box go hand in hand goes back to 1961 when he helped to train a terrorist movement fighting for the reunification of Austria and South Tyrol. I was an explosives expert in the SS, so I trained Burschenschaft on how to make bombs. We used the hotel my wife and I owned as a training camp," he says. The hotel he refers to is 50 yards from his home. 30 people in Italy were murdered during the campaign. One of the men convicted of the atrocities, Norbert Berger, later formed the now-banned neo-Nazi NDP party with Schweiger. Schweiger's involvement earned him his first spell in custody in 1962. But he was acquitted. At Vienna's Documentation Center of Austrian Resistance, or DOW, I speak to Herbert Schreidel, who monitors neo-Nazi activity in the country. He tells me that the glue between people like Schweiger and the politicians are the Burschenschaften fraternities. Schreidel draws two circles and explains. In the circle on the left, you have legal parties such as the FPO or Freedom Party. In the circle on the right, you have illegal groups. Two distinct groupings who pretend they are separate. He draws another circle linking the two together. This circle links the legal and illegal. That signifies the Burschenschaften. They have long been associated with fascism and have a history of terrorism. Adolf Eichmann, Rudolf Hess, and Heinrich Himmler were Burschenschaften, as are prominent members of the FPO in Parliament. There are Burschenschaften groups all over Austria and 18 in the capital alone. Their activities range from quaint to disturbing. At the University of Vienna, members of the Burschenschaften come to pay homage to a statue called the Siegfriedskopf, or the head of Siegfried, a warrior from German mythology. Their ritual takes place every Wednesday. The university authorities wanted to remove the statue, but the government insisted it should stay as it protected a monument, as it is a protected monument, Instead, The piece was relocated to the courtyard. Today, the Burschenschaften have been prevented from entering the courtyard, and at the main entrance, police stand guard as they hand out leaflets. Dressed in traditional uniforms, the Burschenschaften resemble colorful bandsmen and are a far cry from the shaven-head thugs normally associated with fascism. But the groups have a 200-year-old history steeped in patriotism and loyalty to a German state. In 2005, Olympia, one of the most extreme Burschenschaften fraternities, invited David Irving to Austria. As other students gather, there's tension in the air. One girl whispers that this group recently attacked students protesting outside the Austrian parliament against the FPO. A young student with round glasses and a scar on his left cheek wearing the purple colors of Olympia is handing out leaflets. Roland denies being a neo-Nazi, but he quickly starts relaying his fiercely nationalist views. "The anti-fascists are the new fascists," he said. "We are not allowed to tell the truth about how foreigners are a threat." The truth, according to Roland, is that Muslims, immigrants, and America are destroying his way of life. "We are Germans, Austrians. We want a community here based on German nationalism," he says. "We must fight to save our heritage and culture." The Burschenschaften hold regular secretive meetings in cellar bars around Vienna. Journalists are not usually admitted, but I managed to persuade a group of Burschenschaften students to let me see their traditions. Once inside, I find myself in a bar filled with 200 men sitting at long tables drinking steins of Austrian beer. The Burschenschaften are resplendent in the colors of their fraternities. Old and young, they sport sashes in the black, red, and gold of the German flag, and as the beer flows in this neo-Gothic building, chatter fills the room and cigarette smoke rises in plumes up to chandeliers hung from a vaulted ceiling. "Prost," the man sitting to my right toasts loudly. His name is Christian. He is no neo-Nazi thug, but instead a psychology student. His white peaked cap signifies that he is a member of a Burschenschaften group called Gothia. Most of the men at his table are Gothia, including the man sitting opposite who ordered the beer. He glares at me again. He has long scars on both sides of his face that run from his cheekbones down to the edge of his mouth, and when he sucks on his cigarette, he reminds me of the Joker from Batman. Christian has a dozen wounds from fencing, including 5 on his left cheek. "It is a badge of honor to duel," he says proudly, before explaining that this is an annual event and that one of tonight's speeches will be on the threat of Islam to Europe. Suddenly, everyone at our table stands amazed as FPO leader Heinz Christian Strache enters. He's wearing a royal blue hat signifying his membership in the Vandalia Burschenschaften, and after shaking hands with each of us, he sits at the far end of the table. Shortly afterwards, I'm asked to leave. Skipping down. There are no Sieg Heils and no swastikas for the cameras, but it's clear that fascism is back. These are not thugs merely intent on racial violence who are easily locked up. These are intellectuals and politicians whose move to the forefront of society is far more insidious. Through the political influence of the FPO, it is entirely possible that the Verbotsgesetz could be revoked, and if that happens, swastikas could once again be seen on Austria's streets. The ideas and racial hatred that I have heard over my 2 weeks in Austria are just as threatening and just as sickening as any I've ever heard. And they are a lot more sinister because they are spoken with the veneer of respectability. The open defiance of these men honoring their Nazi war hero and the support they're gaining in these troubled economic times should be setting off alarm bells in Europe and the rest of the world. This concludes Side 1 of For the Record Program 677. Update on global fascism. This has been recorded on June 20th of 2009. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.